Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence.
All right, friends, thank you, Pastor Adam. All right. Kiddos, if y'all want to head out with Miss Holly, adults and teenagers, older kids, if you want to find John chapter 7, that's where we're going to be at for the next couple weeks. We're actually going to be in John 7 and 8 for the next probably month, maybe a little bit more. Adam and I were talking shop this week about John, and he reminded me of something I had forgotten, that when we were both early in learning the language of the New Testament, learning Greek, that many of our translations that we had to work on, that we cut our teeth on, were out of John's gospel, because John is one of the easiest gospels to translate from. But it is one of the most profoundly theological and deeply transformative books at the same time. And so while the words in John aren't hard, the theology and the meaning behind those words is very deep and rich, and something you can spend your lifetime trying to understand and still continue to get new things out of. And so that's one of the reasons I love chapter 7 and 8. The other reason I love chapter 7 and 8 is because it forces us to get out of modern culture and into the culture of Jesus. Because there is several significant cultural threads that run in the background that we'll lose something on. We won't gain the fullness of the passage if we don't satisfy understanding those cultural things. So I'm going to go ahead and tell you what we're going to do. We're literally going to read the first two words of this chapter, and we're going to talk. And then we're going to read the first two verses, and we're going to talk about culture, setting, theology, literary background, and all of that for about 5 to 7 minutes. Then we're going to get in, because you've got to understand that, okay? Because it's going to carry with us for the next month, okay? All right, so we're going to read the first two words. Y'all ready? John 7, 1. After this. Now, I don't know if you asked this question, but I asked this question because we haven't been in John in a month, right? So I asked this question, after what? John says, after this. Well, what does that mean, after what? What happened before this? Well, if you don't remember, let's talk about it. After this means after the events of John 6. What occurred in John 6? Well, remember, Jesus ended the chapter with the whole drink my blood, eat my flesh passage. You know? Yay! I mean, you know, that's the evangelist sermon right there, right? No, absolutely not. I'm sure everybody in the crowd was like, no, not this one. The disciples, at least. But he set that up because earlier he was talking about how he was the bread of life and how he satisfied every hunger in our lives. And that happened after he had walked on the water and after he had taught the people and fed them at the feeding of the 5,000, right? And so that whole chapter is about who's nourishing your soul. Well, that came on the heels of chapter 5. And in chapter 5, the big thing that happens in chapter 5 is Jesus, he was near the Passover, and Jesus was going to Jerusalem, and when he gets to Jerusalem, he goes by the pool of Bethesda, and there's a 39-year paralytic laying on the ground. Jesus seeks him out, asks him, hey, do you want to walk? And he says, there's no one here to help me. And Jesus says, take up your mat and walk. And immediately the guy took up his mat and walked. The problem, well, not for the man, but for Jesus, but the problem for the religious society of Jerusalem was that occurred on the Sabbath day. And they didn't like that because that was work in their mind. And so literally John 5 ends with this, paraphrasing here, they sought to kill him. Meaning the Jews, the religious officials, that John calls them the Jews. So if you read, as we're going to read today in the next couple weeks, the Jews, he's not meaning all of the Jews. He's named the religious elite of the Jews. Wanted to kill Jesus. That's why he left and went to in Galilee, where he fed the 5,000, walked on the water, eat my flesh, drink my blood passage, okay? After that are the events of John 7. Now, the time frame between John 6 and John 7 is about 6 months. Between John 5 and John 7 is about 6 months. Because Passover occurs in the spring, what we're about to see occurs in the fall. So let's keep reading the first two verses, then we're going to stop, and we're going to talk a little bit more. All right, so after this, Jesus went about in Galilee, meaning he's walking about in Galilee, northwest Israel, around the Sea of Galilee. He would not go about in Judea. Why? Because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Why were they seeking to kill him? John 5. All right, verse 2. This is the key. This is that key idea we got to talk about. Now, the Jews' Feast of Booths was at hand. Now, let's stop for a minute, because this festival right here, what we've seen is John is rolling through festival after, this is called the festival cycle in John's Gospel. So in chapter 5, we had the Sabbath festival, so that was weekly. In John 6, we had Passover, right? And what did Jesus talk about? Flesh and blood, which is part of the whole, Passover of bread and wine and all that. And then now in John 7, we're talking about the Feast of Booths, which is another festival. And so Jesus is really going to lay into this. Okay, so that's why we got to spend a few minutes to talk about it. All right, so the Feast of Booths was the third of three annual feasts or festivals or kind of big events that all Jewish males were required to attend in Jerusalem. You got Passover, Pentecost, Festival of Booths, or sometimes your translations may say Festival of Tabernacles. It's the same thing, okay? All right, so this is for the last commentators and historians have said this was the most attended festival of the year. Year over year, this one was the highest attended festival. Now, there are three or four layers to this festival, okay? Here's what I want to talk about. There's an agricultural layer. There's a semi-cultural layer. And then there's a theological layer, okay? So let's talk about agricultural. So this feast was set up in the fall after or about the same time as the harvest of wine, grapes, and other tree fruits, okay? So it's kind of at the end of that cycle, sometime in September to October. And so what the people who were picking the tree fruit products, they would literally go out and build makeshift huts to stay in to protect the harvest. Because they would have to stay out in the field and gather it all up. And then, you would have to press the wine, press the olives to make olive oil. You have to press the grapes or they go bad. So it's kind of, this is on the tail end of that process. Okay? So that's the agricultural setting. Keep that in mind. It's also the dry season. So water is at a premium. In fact, Jews believe that if you got rain during the Festival of Tabernacles, it was an absolute sign of God's blessing on the crops that would come the next year. So it's the dry season. Keep that in mind. All right? Agricultural, people build huts to stay and protect the food from the nuts and trees. No water. Water's a premium. Now, here's the kind of cultural kind of thing. This also occurs around the fall equinox. And so what would be built into the stuff that went on in the temple on the last great day, which we'll talk about in several weeks, is there would be a water rite, a water sacrifice type thing, and then there would be one arrest ceremony around light. Now, if you want to read ahead this week, you'll see that Jesus is going to use both of those. But we're not going to get there today. Okay? So there's fall equinox, agricultural stuff, and then over here there's theology. And all three of these are woven together. Because the theology around all of this is the wilderness wanderings. Because what kind of shelters did the wanderers in Exodus live in? Temporary shelters, huts. And so what people would do, not just the agricultural workers picking the tree fruits and all that, but everybody would go like tent camping for the week. They would put together, even if you lived in the city, because most of the houses had a flat roof. You would literally go get whatever palm fronds, trees, sticks. I mean, this is like a little kid, little boy's dream to go make like a stick fort and live in it for a week. Right? Forget it's hot, it's dry, and by the end of the week everybody's cranky and ill. Forget about that. But I mean, they're like, people in the city go on top of the roofs and build these little mech, and they live in it for a whole week. Because that's how old the festival was. But it's a reminder, it's a call back to how God provided for them, even when they didn't have a home, even when it was dry, even when they didn't have any food, even when they didn't have any water, as their ancestors were wandering around in the synagogues. They would teach about the wilderness wandering. And so you have theology, culture, and agriculture all mixed in together in this one piece. And listen to me, Jesus is going to leverage all of that in these two chapters. I mean, every piece of it, he's going to leverage. Okay? So that's why I want to take a few minutes. And you need to keep all of that. So agriculture, harvest, setting of the sun, so to speak, at the fall equinox. Wilderness wanderings. Write them down. Make a note. Because week after week, those themes are going to come back up. And Jesus is going to leverage all of that over the next couple weeks. All right? We good? All right. Now, here's the literary component. The way John organizes these two chapters is around questions and answers. Or I should say statements for questions and answers. So here's how this is going to go. Several people, whether it's the Jews, the group of people, or his brothers, which we'll see in just a minute, will make a statement or respond to something Jesus says or ask a question. And then Jesus will answer that question with more information. This is going to happen, listen to me, 14 times. There are 14 statement questions and Jesus answers in these two chapters. 14 of them. But they all center around four ideas. People are going to question his personhood. People are going to question his mission. People are going to question his background. And people are going to question his allegiance. So if you're looking at your outline, you'll see, like, I've got which one it is noted. Okay? By far, the one that they will question the most is Jesus' background. They'll do that five times. They'll ask him, as we'll see today, what education do you have? What credentials do you have when he's talking about this? They will even, in chapter 8, question the legitimacy of his birth. I mean, come on. When they actually call him, they actually say, you know, we're going to talk about this today, we'll get to it later, just give you proof. They say, well, at least we were illegitimate children. Come on now. Come on. To his face. Not behind his back. At the corner store. To his face in a crowd. And Jesus responds. There's 14 of them, okay? We're going to start out right now. Verse 3. So his brothers said to him, leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples may see the works that you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourselves to the world. So what are the brothers doing? They are questioning his mission. They're like, Mom told us what happened that was recorded in John 66. What was recorded in John 66? It's hard to say. And many of his disciples left and followed him no more. Do you know where it travels? Mom doesn't want to share all the bad news, but you know, when they're the younger brothers of Jesus are like, hey, Mom, what's going on? They're like, yeah, Jesus lost a bunch of his disciples because he gave that whole eat my flesh and drink my blood speech. I've told him not to do that. And so what do the brothers do? They're like, look here, buddy. If you really want to be known, here's what you need to do. And so they question Jesus' mission. They're like, you're not doing it right. You know, friendly help. But we get her through it as what? Passive-aggressive, backhanded compliments, right? Hey, we got this figured out. We know what you want to do. If you're really who you think you are, you should do this. So the question is, what mission is Jesus on? Here's Jesus' answer.
My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to the feast, for my time has not yet fully come. All right, let's go back to verse 5. Jesus says, my time has not yet come. Now, in English, this sounds very similar to what Jesus told his mother in John 2 when he says, my hour has not yet come. But what he's doing is he's saying two different things, okay? And it's hard for us to understand because Greek has three words for time. Three. We have one. Time. It's time to go eat. It's time to go to bed. My time ain't come. They all mean the same thing. Greek's very specific. In this one, Jesus, here's what I'm going to do. The down and dirty. Here it is. Jesus is saying that I follow God's time, and his time is not for me to go to the feast yet. That's what he's meaning. I follow God's time, and his time is not yet for me to go to the feast. I'll go when God says it's time for me to go. But then he says, but your time is always here. So what's he saying to the brothers? He's saying, I'm following God's time. You're not even on God's time. Like, you're not even in the field that God's playing in. One commentator put it so boldly, as he said, Jesus is telling his brothers, you're probably not even a part of God's plan. Why? Because Jesus knows his mission, and he will not be persuaded to do anything other than what God has sent him to do. And so what we see really quickly, and we'll pick this back up at the end of our time this morning, is whenever we misevaluate Jesus, we very quickly misevaluate his mission. And we make Jesus into somebody he never intended to be. I mean, I think, this is a side note, this is not on your outline, I think we can look at the political landscape on the right or the left and say that many on the left and many on the right are trying to make Jesus be okay with whatever their agenda is, when that's not Jesus' agenda at all. Right? Jesus, hey, let's get in it. We here. Let's follow the rabbit. Jesus is not for abortion. And let's be real, Jesus probably ain't for nationalism either. Well, wait a minute. What? Yeah. Like, Jesus has one mission. His mission was to come, be perfect, die on the cross, be buried, and rise again, so that you and I and people not like us could experience the grace of Israel, could believe in him, and come to know him. So many times we try to make Jesus on our mission as if he's cool with our mission, and Jesus tells his own brothers, that ain't my mission. That's not my mission. My time has not yet come. I'm on God's time. I don't know whose time you're on. I'm on God's time. And he said, it's not time for me to go. Now we realize why Jesus' brothers say that in verse 5, because it says, for his own brothers didn't even believe in him. Right? So, again, we'll chase this rabbit, very short rabbit. Look, if Jesus' own brothers didn't believe in him, come on, guys. Like, it's okay if not everybody is like, subscribe, and smashing the like button of your life. Come on. If Jesus is, like, he grew up with these guys, and they're like, yeah, you're not doing it right. We know better. And she said, no, here's my mission. All right? So verses 9 through 13, I'm going to kind of summarize what happens. So his brothers go to the festival. Jesus waits. Jesus goes to the festival around the middle of the festival. The festival is 7 days, so he ends up in Jerusalem on about day 4. But he doesn't go publicly. He goes privately. So he kind of goes under the radar. What's happening while he's not there is everybody's wondering where he's at. And there's big discussion on who Jesus is. Is he really Messiah? Is he a teacher? No, he's leading people astray. But nobody wants to say anything publicly because they're afraid of the religious leaders. So then Jesus shows up in verse number 14. And that's where we're going to pick the story back up. And in verse number 14, Jesus is in the temple at the middle of the festival, and he's talking. Here's what happens. About the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching.
The Jews therefore marveled, saying, here's the next question, how is it that this man has learning when he has never studied? So what's their question? What are they wondering? What background of education do you have, Jesus, to be saved? The things that, where's your paper? Where's your certificate of approval? Where's your diploma? Verse 16. So Jesus answered him. Here's his answer. My teaching is not mine, but is he who sent me. Now listen to what he says in verse 17. This is crucial. If anyone's desire is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. So let's stop right there. We'll read a few more verses later, but let's stop right there. So what's the question? The statement or question is, what educational background, Jesus, do you have? What is your background to be saying the things that you're saying? Because I'm not sure that you're qualified to make these statements. And then Jesus says, if anyone... Now, remember I told you there were five questions about Jesus' background? Of those five, four times, Jesus will give conditional if statements that are crucial, and you need to underline, star, or write, circle them in your Bible, or if you don't want to write in your Bible, do something on your handout sheet. Because every time those questions of his background, Jesus is going to respond with what's in the heart of the person who's asking the question. So the people want to know, what's your background, Jesus? And what does Jesus tell them? He evaluates the heart. He says, if anyone's desire, look at me. The words are very particular. Jesus doesn't say anyone already doing God's will know whether or not my teaching is approved by God or not. He says, if you just desire to do God's will, you will know whether my teaching is from God or if it's not. So what does that tell us about the people asking the question? It's not just that they're not currently engaged in doing God's will. It is that they have no desire, and they don't have an inkling of a desire to do God's will. That's a heart issue. It's not a learning issue. It's not a diploma issue. It's not an educational issue. It is a heart issue. What is Jesus peeling all the layers of the onion back to do? To tell them, your heart is not in the right place. Because if your heart was in the right place, you would desire to do God's will. And if you desired to do God's will, you would know that my teaching is from God. Right? So Jesus peels back the layers and says, your heart is not in the right place. Because if your heart was in the right place, you would desire to do God's will. And when you desire to do God's will, you know where my diploma comes from. And it comes from God the Father himself. Verse 18. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true. So he's seeking the glory of God, not his own. And there's no falsity. Verse 19. Has not Moses given you the law? So this is where Jesus is going to throw it back on him. Yet none of you keeps the law. Why? Because their heart doesn't desire to do God's will. Why do you seek to kill me? Now here's the next question. Okay, this is the question of allegiance. Verse 21. Jesus answered them, I did one work, and you marvel at it. Now this is all, he's referencing all the way back in chapter 5, the healing at the pool of Bethesda. I did one work and you marvel. Moses gave you circumcision. That is not from Moses, but from the fathers. And you circumcised a man on the Sabbath day. If on the Sabbath day a man receives circumcision, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body? Well, don't judge by appearances. Judge with right judgment. All right, so here's the question. The question is, Jesus, you're crazy. You got to be, who's trying to kill you? Right? Are you, possessed? Nobody's trying to kill you. And then Jesus reminds them, oh, yeah, actually they are. Because y'all don't remember what happened at the pool of Bethesda like 6 months earlier? When I healed that guy's whole body, and then Jesus shows them their hypocrisy. Because you know, hypocrisy is, you know, saying one thing and doing another amongst other things. And so what do they say? They say, oh yeah, it's absolutely great to circumcise babies and people and guys on the Sabbath day. That's word. But Moses says it's okay. But yet when Jesus heals the entire person, oh man, excommunicate, kill him, get him out of here. And Jesus points again to what? Their heart. That's why he says, don't judge by what? Appearances, but with right judgment. Because whenever our heart's in the wrong place, whenever the inside of us is in the wrong place, we don't desire to do God's will. Therefore, we don't know that Jesus' teaching is for God. And we also don't judge correctly. We don't evaluate situations, circumstances correctly. Hey, look, let's be real. Come on. You ever been in a emotive state? Have you been in a situation, and you got the situation completely wrong because you didn't see the situation? Come on, this all happened to us. Some of us, it happens to more often than not, unfortunately. Right? Why? Because we didn't see the situation correctly. We couldn't judge correctly. We weren't judging with right judgment. And Jesus, that all goes back to where your heart is. And if you're desiring to do God's will, and if you're seeing that His teaching is from God. Right. Now, I put on your outline at the header that we would go through verse 21, and then I got ambitious and thought we might get through verse 36. But we're going to cut it here, okay? We're going to stop at verse 24. And I'll give you a couple ideas that kind of wrap this session up with the three questions. So we've got a question from his brothers about his mission. We've got a question about his background from the crowd, and then a question about his allegiance from the crowd. So we'll pick back up with some more of the questions next week. But here's what I want you to see. From a macro level, from a top-down level, from the 30,000-foot view of these three questions, and this will be a theme that we'll see throughout the rest of these two chapters, is from a macro level, all three of these questions have something in common. And it is that people asking them misevaluated Jesus. They absolutely misevaluated who Jesus is. So what happens? What happens when they misevaluate Jesus, or when we misevaluate Jesus? I'm going to give you a couple ideas. Here we go. The first is we miss being on God's timing. Because what did he tell his brothers? Hey, you're not even in the right playing field. Stratosphere. You're nowhere close to doing it. And whenever we misevaluate who Jesus is, oftentimes we're either too early, too late, to the right or to the left of where God wants us to be in God's timing. All right, second thing. Whenever we misevaluate Jesus, we end up not wanting to do God's will. Right? Listen, when I was a kid, I shouldn't say kid, when I was in middle school, right? God's will, the language around doing God's will was prevalent in our youth ministry. Not like obsessively present, but I don't remember hearing that, hey, are you doing God's will as a kid? Maybe I did, it just went in one ear, not the other, like many things, you know. But as a teenager, I remember thinking, what does that mean? And so, no fault of any of my Sunday school teachers, pastors, youth pastors, anybody, but I, on my own, assumed that God's will was like, you know, I felt like I was a jungle explorer with a dull machete in dense fog trying to find, like, you know, the holy grail of doing God's will in the jungle. That was my idea. Like, if I could just cut my way through it, but I could never get to it. And then I realized that the Bible is very specific about several things that are God's will, but they're not, like, mind-blowing. It's, you know, they're pretty simple things. You know, grow closer to Christ in likeness. Share your faith. You know,
pray. You just want to read your Bible some. You know, serve other people. And what does Jesus say here? It's part of God's will. Knowing that He teaches truth from God. So it's like, if we ever get to the place where we're confused on, hey, what's God's will? Or especially if we think God's will is for us to do something that's way off the reservation, like it's clearly against Scripture, we've misunderstood who Jesus is. And therefore, we've misunderstood what He's taught. Here's the second. Here's the third thing. Whenever we misevaluate Jesus, we also make wrong judgments, which we talked about. All right, so those are three things directly from this passage that we see. From his brothers, from the second question of the group, and then from the third question about who's going to kill you. Right? Whenever we misevaluate Jesus, those are the three things. So what does it tell us? What's the reverse? When we evaluate Jesus correctly, what happens in life? We agree with Jesus' teachings and follow them. Hey, look, let's be honest here. The church, on a large scale, is having a very hard time with this right now. A very hard time with this. Not our church as a collective group, but the BC church, many of us, I say us because we're in it, have a problem of following Jesus' teachings, believing that that's actually what He meant, and then following them. And so, again, whenever you understand who Jesus is in His own words, that means you follow His teachings as He says them, and then you do those things. Here's the second thing. You'll be able to speak truth. If I don't know if I've ever been alive in a time more desperate for truth than today. Like, not your version of the truth. Right? This is, the truth. Not what you want the truth to be, but your truth. And whenever we evaluate Jesus correctly, we have the ability, not because we're some super spiritual gurus, but because God's truth lives inside of us, then we can speak that truth in other people. Hey, look, your neighbors, your friends, your coworkers, kids, teenagers, the people you sit next to in class, no matter age or what class you're in, they need the truth. And the truth they need the most is not the answer to math problem, although that might be important in that moment for the test. What they need the most is the truth about Jesus and who He is and what He did for them. But we'll never get to that if we evaluate Jesus correctly. And here's kind of a practical, I know this, you already know this, but sometimes we have a hard time doing this. When you evaluate Jesus correctly, there's going to be some people that don't like you. Right?
Yes.
I mean, and you just got to be cool with that. None of us wants to be disliked. Okay? Even the, some of us are kind of introverts and we don't get energy from people, but we don't want people to blow up our Facebook feed with hate mail. Nobody wants that. We all want people to like us. But the reality is, if we truly believe Jesus is who He says He is, and we live that, and we speak that, and we tell the truth about that, then there will be people along the way who will not like us. And you got to be okay with that. Again, Jesus has throngs of people right now in Jerusalem who want Him dead. And before He left, His own brothers don't like Him. Right? They don't like Him because He's mean. They like Him. Why? Because He tells the truth.
Yes. Yes.
And He tells what they don't want to hear. And sometimes, as believers, when we live for Jesus and speak the truth, there's just going to be people who don't like Him. Now, so you just write them off? No. You pray for them.
Yep.
Right? Maybe you pray for them more than you pray for the other people. Right? That they would see the light of Christ in you. You be nice to them. You encourage them. That still don't mean they don't like you. But you've got to be Jesus to them whether they are to you or not. Right? So here's your challenge. Real simple question. Who is Jesus to you? Right? Does Jesus need to have a different mission in your eyes? Is He crazy? Is Jesus some wacko? Who is Jesus to you? Because listen to me. The answer to that question will determine
not just eternity one way or the other, but it will determine how you live your life today. Right? And I want you to live in joy and hope and goodness and God's best for you. But the only way you can do that is if you evaluate Jesus correctly. And you say, all right, you said that a lot, Pastor, so what does that mean? Well, Jesus tells us, Jesus has already told us in the first six chapters of John. And this is it. The evaluation that is correct in Jesus' kind of own words is that Jesus is God's Son, whom God sent to save the world, and you need to believe in him. That's kind of Jesus' right now, up to chapter 7. That's Jesus' evaluation of what you should believe about him. So if you don't hold that, then I would ask you to question why, and then why not? Why not believe Jesus? Right? That's on you. You've got to figure that out today. Because it will transform not only the way you end up in eternity, but the way you live today and tomorrow.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.